Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Small Business Digest Radio. My name is Don Mazzella, and I am your host for a program devoted to identifying strategies and suggestions to help small business managers increase profits, add sales, better manage cash flow, improve employee management, and streamline operations. Our guests are other entrepreneurs and experts offering their solutions to the problems and opportunities facing small business leaders. Our aim in each program is to provide one or two thought-provoking ideas or suggestions. So follow us on Twitter at #2SBDigest or at our website at www.smallbusinessdigest.net.
I'm really particularly happy tonight to have with us TJ Gentle. He's CEO of SmartFurniture.com and a member of the President's Small Business Advisory Board. He's here to show us some of the things he's learned about improving the customer engagement and improving profits along the way. As we always do with all of our guests, TJ, welcome to the program, and please tell us a little bit about yourself personally before we get into anything else.
Well, thank you very much, Don, and I appreciate you having me. As you said, I'm TJ Gentle, President and CEO of SmartFurniture.com. I have been CEO of Smart Furniture for about 5 years. Prior to that, I was with the company. I started with the company around 2004, and through that time period, I guess I have become I was always sort of a technologist, but I've learned quite a bit about furniture over the last 10 years. When I started, I didn't know a whole lot. Believe it or not, before that, I was a corporate lawyer, helping small businesses, startups, and technology companies raise money, do acquisition structure, strategic partnerships, and was a corporate lawyer for a while. And through that experience, I guess I ran into a lot of small businesses, and that's when I met up with the founder of Smart Furniture, who had started the company in Palo Alto around 2001, and moved it to where we are now, headquartered in Chattanooga, Tennessee, around 2001-2002. And I quickly met up with this guy, his name's Stephen Culp, one of the smartest guys I've ever met, and very, very dear friend. And he, we've sort of worked together to build a company the way that we wanted, I guess, the way we felt like it ought to be built. And at Smart Furniture, we're blessed to have a fantastic team, very talented people, and most of us love to get up and go to work every day, which is about all you can ask for.
I'm curious. You went from corporate lawyer to corporate executive. What motivated you to do that?
You know, I've had several years to reflect on that answer now, and you know, the firm I worked at sort of had a track history of taking corporate lawyers and putting them into boardrooms and into corporate executive. For example, Lowery Klein was a partner in the firm I worked with, and he became the CEO of Coca-Cola Enterprises, which was at the time the largest bottler of Coca-Cola in the world. And there were about four or five other examples. And I think the firm that I worked at had it was sort of a multidisciplinary approach to training. So even though I was a corporate lawyer by training, I took they paid for me to take lots of business school classes and really helped me diversify my education while I was on the job and encouraged sort of that business advisor / corporate lawyer role, and I quickly realized that I was not conservative enough to be a lawyer. I was more of a risk taker, and I really wanted to get my hands dirty. And after seeing so many businesses helping them raise money and become successful, I really wanted to jump in there and do it myself. And boy, did I ever jump in.
Obviously, you jumped right into it. We were talking earlier, and you said along the way you've made mistakes, and you've learned from them. But now you really want to talk about how you can improve the profitability and the customer engagement and utilize data.
That's right. You know, I think one of the things that happens a lot when you run a business is, you know, if you have professional investors and board members, is a lot of times you begin to doubt your own ideas, and you think someone has to know better than I do how to do this or that. And, you know, business is, I guess one way to put it is business is not you know, complicated. It's just a lot of hard work, and you have to sort of put in the time and the effort to figure out, you know, where your place is. And one of the things that I learned very early was if you treat customers the way you want to be treated when you're a customer, everything else sort of works its way out. And if there's one thing we call that the golden rule of customer service here, but that sort of is like the cornerstone of what we've built. And what we've tried to do from there is to use all the convenience and special features and applications that we can, you know, manifest on the internet, and to really create a better experience for customers when they try to buy furniture. So at a very basic level, one of the things we focused on over the last couple of years is really getting to know our customers and trying to break that down into a very simple data structure so that we can segment customers. And by segmenting them, and then we ask them questions, you know, if they're willing to answer them, if they're willing to create a profile, some of those questions are, you know, instead of us trying to guess at what customers want, if we ask them and get an idea of some of their characteristics, that gives us half the equation. What we've done on the other side, and what I think is, as a retailer, is very important for any retailer, particularly if they're trying to compete in today's marketplace with big companies like Amazon, is I think it's important that you know your products very well. And so one of the things that we've done is taken the thousands and tens of thousands of SKUs that we have and refine them to the ones that we know best, and then break each of those products down into what we call attributes. And, you know, for example, if it's a sofa, one of the things that a very common attribute is, what style is it? Is it modern? Is it contemporary? Is it casual? Is it traditional? And then we try to rate that relative to all the other products in the category. And if you think about that one attribute, you know, if you can sort of say what makes a sofa, there are dozens and dozens of data points there. You know, what's the material? What is the, you know, is it comfortable? Is it plush? Is it soft? How much does it cost? Is it a good value? How many features does it have? We take all those data points, and then we try to match them using an algorithm to each of the customer's characteristics. And basically what we've tried to do is all that is a very complicated way of saying that what we've really tried to do and what we're having some success at is basically treating the customer experience on smartfurniture.com in the same way that you would have experienced years ago in a retail store when the sales clerk was very knowledgeable about what he sold and knew the customer. So if you think of sort of going into a drugstore in a small town, you know, the person who works behind the counter there knows the people coming in, know all the products they have, and they also know, you know, what product's going to be best for that customer's problem. And at its essence, that's really what we've tried to do with Smart Furniture and with the website, is to take all the institutional knowledge that we've created over the years and to make it available, you know, at the touch of a few buttons to customers, so that they get the best results that we can provide. Now, since we've done that, I think the results have been, we started off doing this because we wanted to take what were fantastic salespeople that we have, and we wish that everyone could experience, you know, if you're ordering on the internet, you know, very few people call in. But we have such good salespeople, we thought this, if we could just make our website as convenient and useful and helpful as our salespeople are, that in the end of the day would provide a better customer experience. And so far what we found is when customers visit our site and go through what we call smart profile, they actually are converting at 10 times the rate of a standard visitor. And during that process, they typically spend about 27% more. And those stats are great because it validates to me that we're helping people find what they want to find. But even better than that, what we're starting to see now is that customers are returning who've gone through this and ordering more, and their satisfaction level with the products they're purchasing are higher. So, you know, this is, we think we're onto something, and it really is sort of, at its essence, going back to the roots of what is the role of a retailer in the value chain, and using, you know, all this technology and all this data we have at our convenience to not, you know, muddle the process, but to make it simpler and more intuitive for the customer.
Well, if I'm hearing it right, just so and that was a very articulate. What in essence you're saying is you're drawing from the customer more information, which enables you to go back and better pinpoint what he or she needs, and be able to deliver a better sales experience. Would that be?
That's a much better way to say what I just said. And I would say, you know, the only thing I would add to it is we really want it to be, once they do the profile, we want everything to be intuitive from that point, as if, you know, we're already solving the problems that the customer's going to have before they occur. And so, you know, we're using all that information that they give us and all the information we have to really just create a better experience. And the key to that is, you know, getting to know what matters to your customer and then getting to know, you know, how the products you sell actually relate to those factors that matter to customers. And that sounds very basic, but, you know, in a world where, you know, I would say, you know, if you think about Walmart and what they do, they buy lots of products and they put them on the shelves, and if people need a widget, they go there and they get it. And, you know, there are times when you may not want the widget quite the way that Walmart has it, but if you're going to get it from Walmart, you're going to get the widget the way they have it. And I think that in a world with so much competition, there is room for variety and room for customization, and I think that's our role as smaller businesses, is to find those areas where, you know, maybe we don't deal in the volume that big stores like Walmart or Amazon have, but we find the other things that make people happy, and we make sure that they're available.
Well, it's interesting. You, normally, large retailers are saying customers are going into their shop, looking at the product, then going online and buying it. You're in effect saying, come online and we'll help you make a more informed decision.
That's exactly right. I think that's sort of a, when I think of why I think what we're doing is unique, we actually want, you know, if you go to Walmart and you need help, good luck. You know, they can tell you what aisle something's on, but their knowledge of the product is very limited.
Can I tell you? No, finish, please.
And if you go online to Walmart, you know, say for whatever reason you get on the phone and see, you know, that particular product, you can read reviews of what other people have done and other people have bought, you know, that product and what they think. What I think has happened is Walmart, in effect, has I guess, outsourced its role in the value chain to customers, where customers are sort of saying, I tried this and it didn't work, or I tried this and it worked. And the difference that we're trying to do is we're trying to anticipate what they need based on our knowledge of the products. And we call this prescriptive personalization. We're trying to basically prescribe products for customer attributes or customer characteristics. That way, you know, we know our customers well, we know our products well, and our role, we see our role is combining those two in a way that's really useful and intuitive for customers. And, you know, I don't think a lot of companies are doing that, but I do think that in the coming years, as data, you know, the big data movement continues to consume more of the technology spend, I think lots of the data scientists that are running these things now, there'll come a point where you really have to have people as part of the equation who actually understand the products they're selling, and whether that's by, you know, trial and error or really coming down to fundamentally knowing the products and trying to anticipate what people need rather than throwing it out there, people try it, and then using ratings to value how good it is. I think that ratings are great, but I think that the back end of the equation, I think the front end of the equation, is where we as retailers have a role and to try to anticipate needs.
Well, I have to tell you, TJ, we have a Walmart near us, one of the large ones, and half the staff does not speak English. They're Hispanic, and I don't speak Spanish. And sometimes it becomes a very interesting customer experience finding someone. I really appreciate what you're saying. But let me ask you a question. I mean, you mentioned a sofa. I don't know about you, but I'd like to test out a sofa before I bought it to make sure I could lay it down in it the way I like. You're in effect saying to your customer, we can develop from this data, we can find the sofa that fits you.
You know that you right there cut at the heart of why it's hard to sell furniture on the internet. The furniture is a very intimate purchase, and you whether you realize it or not, your relationship with the furniture you buy is very important, and you always sort of realize that at the point of purchase because furniture is not cheap. And for the longest time, the e-commerce industry and the private equity and venture capital money has ignored the furniture part of e-commerce for that very issue, that issue being that people fundamentally want to touch what they're buying when they buy furniture. And then the second issue is when you try to move that across the country, it becomes very expensive. Well, we can only, as a e-commerce retailer that doesn't, we have one sort of concept studio. We don't have retail stores throughout the country. But I think part of the winning formula in the end is to make sure that you at least have a location where you can satisfy some of those tactile needs from customers, you know, that, and you know, we've tried to come up with creative ways to solve that problem, and I'll sort of outline a few that might be useful to listeners as they think about their business. But one is providing very detailed employee reviews of the product, where they talk about, you know, things like firmness, they talk about the materials. We also have a pretty liberal swatch policy, meaning, you know, if people are worried about fabrics, you know, we'll make sure we send them fabrics at no cost. But fundamentally, there's still this issue of, when I sit on it, am I going to like it? And, you know, the only way for us to really address that with customers is to provide a fantastically customer-oriented return policy. And as a company that is very customer-focused, this is very expensive for us. But what we do is we give customers basically a free 45-day return policy. And if they get the product, they sit on it, and they don't like it, we take it back and pay the return shipping and refund their money. And, you know, there are some exceptions to that that we've had to make over the years because, you know, they're some of the things we sell are so expensive or are made to order that it's very hard to do that with. But in general, by having that very liberal return policy and trusting that customers won't take advantage of it, what we've done, in effect, is, you know, we've done the best we can without allowing them to physically touch the product. And believe it or not, our return rate is about 2.5%, which what I've learned over the years is amazingly low for an e-commerce company and particularly low for a furniture company. So I think by trusting customers and fully informing them, we help to some degree. I do think that at the end, when everything is sort of settled, the way to really solve this problem is to do what we're doing, but to also have physical locations accessible to as many people as you can so that they can touch and feel what they're buying and that where you don't have to worry about, you know, paying all the logistics costs of moving things back and forth. There was one other point to this, and I do think that you and I have made up our minds that when we buy furniture, we want to touch it or sit on it. Most furniture purchases are you know, the biggest in the consumer life cycle for furniture is one of the biggest waves of spending comes in the early 30s. That's when people typically settle down, they get a job, they get married, start to have kids, and then they buy furniture. Well, you know, if you think about who's turning 30 right now and 31 and 32, these are people who have done everything on the Internet. You know, some of them met their spouses on the Internet. They, you know, they've broken up with people on the Internet. They've met friends. They've bought everything on the Internet. And this millennial group, their perception or their sort of view is that everything should be purchasable on the Internet. So there's a whole wave of consumers sort of coming of age at the sort of beginning of the life cycle of the for furniture purchases who expect to buy everything on the Internet. Now, they may learn that they want to touch and feel it or test it out, but right now, if you're not selling your products and making them available in the furniture industry on the Internet, you're missing the next generation of consumers because the millennials expect to shop for and buy everything on the Internet. And that is a massive change that will you know, ripple throughout the furniture industry for years to come.
Well, TJ, 2 points because we're getting close to the end. When you say you arrange, do you send your customers to a specific store in their area? Do you have an agreement with them? What do you do?
Right now, there are a few cases where we have certain brands that we have. They have concept stores, and we'll send them there. But right now, a lot of times what we'll do is say, this is a store that has it in your area. Go there. And we realize that they may actually buy that product from that store, even though it's not us. And we've just referred a customer there. And we do that pretty frequently when people really want to see a product. What we've always said is, if you go there and you don't get better service than you get from us, you know, if they don't treat you right, come back. But I do think in the end, a company like ours who can partner with an existing retail chain that has locations throughout the country, and make sure that there's inventory available, you know, for, across all brands. I think that that, you know, omni-channel experience will ultimately be the one that becomes a leader in the industry. I think it'll be very hard to become, you know, the dominant name in furniture without having, you know, the physical brick and mortar stores as well as a fantastic internet presence.
Well, TJ, I want you to come back because we have definitely want to have a longer program with you. But before you leave, you're on the President's Small Business Advisory Board. Tell us a little bit about that briefly. We do have to move on, but please tell us a little bit about that.
You know, it's an exciting experience, and it's sort of, you know, being in the right place at the right time. By the way, I'm politically an independent, which in East Tennessee means I'm a liberal, but by, you know, the rest of the country, I'm very moderate. A lot of what we do there is we, when the president has a particular policy or initiative that he is considering or putting into play, that we actually have a board that sits and talks with senior administrative officials or senior White House officials about how that we see that that impacts small business and particularly our businesses and how that will be viewed or how it will translate to business and economic growth. And for me, it's very exciting to be engaged in those discussions. And it's an honor to, you know, sit at the table and discuss policy with leaders in, of the country, and oftentimes very surreal. But at the end of the day, you know, these folks are really trying to do what's best, and they want economic growth. And what I've realized is that, you know, businesses have a voice there, and I think the closer we can come to talking directly to the, you know, the White House and the administrative officials instead of talking through lobbyists, you know, the more productive the discussions are. So it's been an exciting organization to be part of, and I hope that I've had some impact along the way.
Well, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot. If 59% of our audience is either president and or owner, could they email you to express their, get you to express their views in these things?
You know, I would, sure. I mean, if there are issues, I would love to hear from them. Do you want me to provide you the email address, or do you want to put it on the website?
Both.
Have them email twg@smartfurniture.com.
twg@smartfurniture.com. TJ,
right.
You have to come back. We have to go to our next guest, but you have to come back. I hope you will. We'll talk some more.
I would enjoy that very much. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming on board. And we'll, as I say, we'll definitely have you back.
Have a good evening.
And you have a good evening. Our next guest should be Mark Fagiano, CEO and founder of TaxJar. Are you
hey,
on?
Don.
How are you, Mark?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Is that a nice Italian name?
Yeah, sure is. And you did pretty darn well there pronouncing it. Thank you.
With a name like Mazzella, if I didn't do that right,
that's true.
I usually butcher names, but yours was an easy one. Mark, we always ask our guests first to talk about a little bit about themselves personally, how you got there, a little bit about yourself, so that the audience gets a little bit of a flavor of you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm a guy who always growing up knew wanted to be an entrepreneur, or probably more accurately wanted to work for myself. So finally took that leap a little more than 10 years ago. I did spend a little bit of time after college working in the corporate world, and that sort of validated the fact that I never wanted to really have a boss and work in a big corporate environment. So started my first company about 10 years ago, I've started a handful of companies since then, some with mild success, some with pretty good success. So I've been able to sell a couple of companies. And my primary focus is solving pain for small businesses. So I'm really passionate about enabling small businesses to do what they want to do, which is grow. And there are a lot of administrative, back office types of things that get in the way. And what I really enjoy doing is building products online that allow them to get sort of pass along those problems to someone like me who can take the burden off of their shoulder and then focus on how to grow their business. So that's kind of the quick overview, but that's led me to founding TaxJar last year. TaxJar is sort of the perfect example of an administrative burden. Sales tax is probably the craziest thing that a small business owner could have to deal with, especially if they have an online presence.
Okay. Where did you grow up?
Grew up on the East Coast, in Boston, born and raised there. Moved to California about 14 years ago, and came out here to go to grad school and thought I'd be here for a couple of years, but realized how great the weather was and the lifestyle out here, and haven't left yet.
After this winter, I'm thinking of joining you.
Yeah, I grew to really despise snow. I just couldn't take it anymore. So that was all the motivation I needed to say goodbye to winter and just move along.
Well, as we both know, and as every small business has been, interesting statistic, the average sales footprint of companies in the last 4 years has grown from 50 miles to now almost 90 miles,
mm-hmm.
which then encompasses a very large, a lot of jurisdictions. And as
sure.
you said, one jurisdiction has one set of taxes and then another. So tell us what TaxJar does.
Sure. So that's a great stat, actually. I'll have to remember that one. TaxJar essentially handles what we call post-transactional sales tax compliance. And really what that means is everything that happens after you've collected sales tax. In the grand scheme of things, really nothing about sales tax is easy if you're a small business owner, but if you're apples to apples, collecting the sales tax is the easier part. It's everything that comes after that. And what I mean by that is filing sales tax returns. And that's particularly challenging for folks that run an online business or have a brick-and-mortar business with an online presence. Because as you said, Don, really you're selling once you go online, you're essentially a nationwide company, if not a worldwide company. What a lot of our customers have are potential sales tax involvement with not only maybe their jurisdiction, but other jurisdictions in their state, but also with other states too. So what we find is that a lot of folks who, the more they become successful selling online, the bigger the burden grows. So we try to alleviate that with a reporting system. It's an automated reporting system that essentially provides a business owner with the data that they need to be able to file the sales tax return in whatever states they have nexus in. And the reason that's particularly challenging, you may hear that and say, well, people keep good sales records and it's probably not that hard. And the reason why it is hard is because people these days are selling on more than one channel. They typically have, just as an example, an eBay store, a store on Amazon. They have their own website. They go to some kind of craft fair on the weekend and try to sell inventory there. So they've got monies in all these different channels, collecting sales tax in different ways on different channels. And all of those have different sales tax implications. So just trying to compile all that data and get the data that you need. Some states actually require you, a lot of them require you to subtotal your sales by jurisdiction. So it's not good enough just to say, okay, state of New York, I collected $1,000 in sales tax this year, here you go. The state like New York wants you to subtotal that out by every one of the jurisdictions that you made a sale in. And the reason being is because they don't know otherwise how to divide up the money that you're sending them. There are all of the counties and cities and special taxes that are in New York, all of them have a share of the sales that you've made. So the onus is on the seller, the small business owner, to actually do that work to provide a report to the state. And that's what's very, very time-consuming for the average small business, and that's what we eliminate with our automated reporting.
But I was under the impression, maybe I'm wrong, that if I sell a product on the Internet, I didn't have to, and if I wasn't physically located in the state, I didn't have to pay do the sales tax. Am I wrong on that point?
No, so here's how that's changed. 5 years ago, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, but what's changed is, so let me back up and say, in general, you're correct, but here's where the laws are being blurred. What's happening is more folks are selling online, and they're using third-party logistics companies. In Amazon, folks that sell on Amazon are a perfect example. Amazon actually has a service where you can allow Amazon to do all of your fulfillment for you. So you essentially have the opportunity to use the best logistics company in the world. All you got to do is send them your inventory. When an order gets placed, they ship it out for you. But what happens is that Amazon's got this whole network of warehouses all around the country. So they take your inventory that you send to them, and then they disperse it to these warehouses, depending on, you know, an algorithm that they have that says, you know, your items sell better in the Southwest or, you know, Northwest or something like that. And what the states now say, Don, is that, okay, we'll take state of Washington, for example. I don't care if you've never been here. I don't care if you don't have an employee here or a storefront. If you're storing your inventory here, that's sufficient enough where you need to now comply with our sales tax laws. And that's where the game is really changing, because more and more online businesses are using these logistics companies and are, you know, bumping into this to this situation where their Nexus portfolio is growing beyond just their home state.
Wow. What I love about this program is I learn something new every show. But if I have my inventory in New Jersey, let's say, I have to collect the tax if I sell it to New Jersey. But as long as I don't use one of these distribution companies, I don't have to collect the tax if I sell a product in Missouri, say.
Yeah. So I'd say in general, right? If you don't have your inventory in Missouri, you don't have a storefront in Missouri, you don't have a salesperson in Missouri, you don't have an employee in Missouri, you probably then don't have to comply with sales tax law in Missouri, which means you don't have to collect sales tax on any items sent to a customer in Missouri.
But does Amazon and the other distribution companies, do they tell you when you sign up with them that you've got to collect the tax?
They don't.
I'm in shock right now, I tell you.
Don, it's sad, and we hear a lot of the customers that we get at TaxJar are actually folks that are finding out about this, you know, after the fact. In some cases, pretty long after the fact. So when they sign up for this logistics service, it's called Fulfillment by Amazon, there's nothing on there that says, you know, by using this service, you could potentially be you know, adding sales tax liability to, you know, X number of states. And it's either through the education that we're providing, or these sellers are pretty tight networked together. They may, you know, hear it from a peer, but that's typically how they find out. And, you know, of course, worst case is they find out from a state themselves that says, hey, look, we notice you're doing a pretty good amount of sales here. You're supposed to be complying with our sales tax law. Those cases aren't as many right now, but, you know, if you talk to sales tax experts and tax professionals, they expect that type of enforcement to go up. And the reason being, not defending the states, but look, I'm in California, and this state is, although our financial situation has picked up a bit, at the end of the day, they all need more revenue, and they are really looking hard at enforcing sales tax laws as one of the big ways to try to increase revenue.
Mark, I noticed that our last guest has come on the board. I want you to stay on because I want to continue the conversation. But Bill Cummings is about to join us, and he talks about the 13 most common mistakes business owners make. But I'd like to kind of bring the two of you together. Would you mind holding a second?
All yeah, right. go for it.
Bill, I just unmuted you. Welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, I should say, Donald. How are you doing today?
We're doing fine. You're on with Mark Fagiano, CEO and founder of TaxJar. Bill, you're here to talk about the 13 common, but I want to keep Mark on a little further because I'm just learning something very interesting, and we'll get to you, and we're also going to ask your take on this, if you don't mind waiting a couple more minutes while we talk with Mark, and then keep Mark and you on, okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Mark, I want to get back to you because this is kind of interesting, to me interesting. I like to pride myself. I know a lot about small business. I've been doing it for over 20 years, reporting on small business. How does your product work?
So you can sign up for an account with us. It literally takes probably about 30 seconds. And then what you do is you essentially connect where you're selling to TaxJar. So if you're selling on Amazon, you can connect your account to us. If you're selling on eBay, you can connect your PayPal account to us. And we're integrated with a number of different seller platforms. And then what we do is we pull down your sales and sales tax data and use that to populate reports for any state that you're collecting sales tax in. And we automate those reports. They get updated every single night. You know, most of our folks are doing, you know, a bunch of sales every day, if not, you know, per hour. So the reports are always constantly changing. That's pretty much it. That's how it works. We use the technologies that these seller platforms make available to anyone. And fortunately, we have a bunch of smart developers that are able to make something like that work. And it's using all the kind of latest and greatest technologies that makes it super easy for our users and customers to be able to get the information that they need.
Well, how do you charge? By number of transactions?
Sure. So we have a 30-day free trial, so anybody can try it for free with no credit card required. And then our pricing is based on how many transactions your business is doing per month. So our pricing starts at $9.95 a month for up to 1,000 transactions, and then we have plans that go all the way up to $50 a month for 15,000 transactions. And those transactions are regardless if you're collecting sales tax or not and wherever you're doing sales. So, you know, if it's in your state or out of state or international, each one of those counts as a transaction. And we also have enterprise plans for folks doing more than 15,000 transactions per month.
Well, Mark, some of our people, the name of your website?
It's taxjar.com.
Spell it out. This is radio.
Sure, yeah. It's taxjar.com.
If they want to talk to you?
Yep, they can, they can email me directly at Mark, M-A-R-K, at taxjar.com.
Well, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate I learned something. I was at a briefing in Washington earlier this late in February, and there a couple of tax experts said that they expected that small businesses would see a whole raft of state-imposed taxes on internet sales. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, I think as bad as it is, it has the potential to get worse. I hate to say that, but you know, your guess is as good as mine. Say it again.
Good for you. It'll be good for you. But
well, it would. But honestly, you know, there's the pending legislation called the Marketplace Fairness Act. It's sitting before committee in the House right now. We've actually come out against it. We're the only company in this industry that's come out against it, even though we would benefit from it. The reality is this stuff it's too time-consuming and too complicated. The legislation that they're considering passing would make it a whole lot worse for people that don't deserve it. So there's got to be a better way to do this, our company will survive and still make money, but I'd hate to see the legislation that's in front of Congress right now pass.
Well, on that unfortunate note, we're going to say thank you and hope you come back another time and see how things are going.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay, Val, bye-bye.
Bill, thank you for being
patient. Yes, I'm here.
I know. Thanks for being patient. I've been looking forward to this one. We're a small business. What I saw was selecting the wrong business entity, the 13 most common mistakes. We always ask, though, first, before we get into that, for our guests to say a little bit about themselves personally, what they do, how they got here, et cetera. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. The name is Bill Cummings, and I'm the president and CEO of a Cummings Financial Organization. We're kind of a boutique CPA firm. We're a financial services firm in sunny Tampa, Florida, and we do a number of things, but tax reduction for small business owners. I have a lot of business owners as clients. We also we do some financial planning and estate planning as well, but I do a lot of advising and business consulting as well, even getting to the point where owners sell their businesses. So I've been in business for about 25 years, and I've seen a lot of things. It's interesting you were talking about internet sales, and I agree with the previous caller in that you're going to start seeing all the states coming in as a source of revenue. Because the big box stores also want to be able to do that as well. I mean, they're getting, you know, you go to a store, you pay sales tax, so why should you not do it on the internet? So one of the things as a CPA is that, you know, it's a constant struggle every year to figure out ways to lower your tax bill, because that is, as a business owner, usually one of your largest business expenses.
Okay. So now the floor is yours. Tell us how to do
okay.
it.
All right. Well, and you know, you had me on the radio before, and you know, again, in my background, I was a CFO of a very large corporation. We did about $200 million in sales, $150 to $250 million. And again, one of the luxuries we had was a tax planning department. And, of course, the sole purpose of this tax planning department was to help our firm pay the least amount in taxes. And, in fact, you know, there were often years where their tax bill was less than mine, their own CFO, and they certainly made a lot more money than I did. And that was kind of an aha kind of moment for me, because what really happens in the real world with businesses, and I'm seeing it, I mean, you know, the business returns are due on by Monday, March, whatever day that is, 17th, and what happens is the business owners are busy. They, you know, bring their pile of receipts in February and March, and there's not much an accountant can do at that point to save the business owner any money. And so that's what really inspired me to write this book. I wanted to make a simple book to tell people that the book is all about tax planning. It's all about doing stuff at year end and always questioning why you're doing something. Why are you doing this? One of the first questions I ask people is, okay, you're an LLC, why? And usually they say, well, it's for legal reasons and my friend's an LLC, or they don't know why they're an LLC. And so what I try to do is question everything that they're doing and saying, is there a better way to do it that will result in a lower tax bill for you? And so it really puts the business owner into being more, because, you know, business owners are so busy trying to grow their business. I mean, I'm, I guess, a small business owner. We have less than 25 employees, but I'm trying to grow my business. I'm trying to manage my employees. I'm negotiating operating leases, and, you know, I'm working on the business. And your tax bill, again, is one of your largest business expenses. So why wouldn't you spend time at least planning quarterly, semi-annually, annually? You should be reviewing it and with your accountant and planning before year end, so that you can have everything in place so that when it comes tax time, then you're not going to get a big surprise. The big surprises this year are going to come around April 15th, or just about this time now, when people see that there's new, you know, tax rates, there's exemptions that are minimized this year, and there are a lot more taxes from the Affordable Care Act. So a lot of people are starting to see that now. We've already had a few clients come in, and they were just, you know, they had a couple bombshells coming in, and that's because they didn't do any planning before year end. And it's too late now. I mean, we can do something for 2014. So what I always tell people is that, listen, the number one mistake that you make as a business owner is failing to plan. I mean, it's just flat out, if you're just dropping off your tax returns at year end and having a phone conversation, because let's face it, your CPA, your accountant, is really busy right now. They're in what I call tax hell. They're not fun to be around because they have this deadline coming up to get the tax returns done. So you're not going to get their time right now. The time you're going to get is in September, October, November, when you should be sitting down with them and at least going through and trying to figure out, you know, what's the best action to take. So the second biggest mistake that people make is the wrong business entity. And usually when somebody starts off, it may make sense at that point, but it may make sense down the road. Some of the things to keep in mind is, do you have a lot of medical expenses that you're not deducting on your personal returns because you're not getting over the AGI, the 7.5% AGI and 10% AGI for medical expenses. So there are ways to put that through LLCs and C Corp, actually out of pocket expenses. S Corps we sometimes use to minimize payroll taxes. So that's often a common strategy as well. So Donald, from your standpoint, you were saying that you were just recently at a tax conference, correct?
Right, correct.
And what was some of the concerns coming from that tax conference?
Well, I think mainly it dealt with three issues. The tax implication of Obamacare.
That's correct.
The greater aggressiveness of states in particular to go after small business for whatever revenue they can generate, because, as you just said, small businesses don't plan, and
right.
And they often leave themselves open. And the other major thing was that the various taxes on employees, Obamacare, I forget what the percentage, there's a certain tax now on the disability and all of the FICAs, et cetera. And,
That is correct. Yes, that is correct. There is a in particular, there's one for that's an extra 0.9% percent on FICA for Affordable Care Act. But there's also a 3.8 of unearned income, and there's some new rules that just came out on what that is. And so, if you meet certain thresholds, you know, if you're single or married, there's certain thresholds for being over that, then you have an extra 3.8%. So on the Affordable Care Act, one of the biggest things that we're seeing from a business owner standpoint is business owners missing the tax credit. So let me explain how that works. Starting in 2010, for businesses with less than 25 employees that made less than $50,000 a year, there's a 35% tax credit for any health insurance that you as an owner provide, and you have to provide at least 50% of the cost. So it's kind of a graduated grid. So the more money your employees made, the less of a credit you get. So if you had 25 employees all making 50 grand a year, your credit would be zero. But if you had a bunch of workers making $30,000 a year and you had 10 employees, you may get that 35% tax credit. So if you do the numbers, you know, and you're paying, I don't know, let's say $500 an employee, you know, times 12, that's $6,000, you could potentially get a 35% tax credit for that individual worker if you were paying 100% of their health care. And an interesting statistic that the Journal of Accountancy put out, that the Governmental Account Agency said that in 2010, 4 million businesses, small businesses, were eligible for this tax credit, but yet only about 170,000 actually applied for it.
Absolutely.
So what's happened in 2014 is that credit goes to 50%, and it's available for 2 years. The good news, and we've amended quite a few returns this year for new clients that we have, you know, you can go back a few years, 3 years, if you didn't apply for this credit. So that's a pretty good client when we come in and go, oh, you didn't get the health care credit, and we run the numbers on our spreadsheet, and then we apply, and sure enough, you know, it comes back as a credit. And so, you know, the Affordable Care Act was the biggest bill that's ever been done, and it had the most tax changes since like 1970 for any one bill. And oversight of it is questionable to me as well, because you got the health agency and you got the IRS. The interesting thing about the IRS is they have jurisdiction over that penalty. So individuals have to have insurance. In fact, you know, we ask that, and employees are starting to report it. I forgot who it was today. Somebody told me today that they were doing their taxes on TurboTax, and the question was asked, do you have health care? And so the way the IRS now has jurisdiction on that penalty. So you have to have insurance by April 31st or you'll get a penalty this year. And
well,
it's based on your age. I'm sorry, it's based on your income level and whether you're single and a number of other factors. But it starts at like $95 a year and it goes up and then it maxes out at like 2% of income.
Well, but the interesting The Wall Street Journal today is reporting that a little noticed announcement by the IRS has suspended that requirement for the next 2 years for just about everybody.
It's such a moving part, Donald, that I give the Affordable Care Act presentations all the time, and I have I would have to show you the folder. I know we're on radio, but every time I give that speech, and I didn't see that. I get the Wall Street Journal, but we're a little busy these days. And every time I've ever given that speech, some major announcement was made that affected my presentation, and I keep them all in there. And so here's the interesting thing about from the joint taxation on the penalty. The IRS has jurisdiction of the penalty, okay? But it's not like when you don't pay taxes where they can, you know, accrue interest and charge you penalty. The IRS doesn't have that at their disposal. In fact, they can't even collect it from you. They can't come after your property for it. The only thing that they can really do is withhold any money that's due you. So if you're getting a refund of $400 and the penalty was $95, they would withhold that $95.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you owe them money and you underpaid every year, and they really can't come after you. From everything that I'm reading, I mean they can't put liens on your property. They can't do any of that. So it's very interesting. I'm going to look at that article of what you just said, but the W-2s that I've seen have been inconsistent of whether they have insurance or not.
It's truly amazing. We're getting close to the end of our time. The name of your book and how people can get it and how they can talk to you.
The name of the book is Bad Luck or Bad Business. It's on Amazon.com. And my website is William Cummings, CUMMINGS, CFO.com. There's also, you can order it through there. You can also ask me questions on there. You can also call me at 877-453-7737. And you can just tell them that you heard me on the radio show and would like to have a quick talk. Usually when I meet with the client for the first time, and I have a lot of clients over the phone. We do what's called a mini tax planning session. It usually takes about a half an hour. We don't usually charge for that. And I just look at their tax reviews their taxes, because I'm trained to just look at it and I pinpoint certain things and go over it. And I usually know within about 20 minutes or so whether there can be some potential savings from an actual tax plan. We just did one this morning with somebody that was a referral. They called me on the phone, probably asked them 6 questions. I know I'm going to be able to help this guy. I'm meeting with him again. He's bringing his tax stuff, and I know I can help them. So just because you did it the same way last year doesn't make it right. And change is good sometimes. So if you need a second opinion, just give me a call. And Donald, I always enjoy being on this on the call with you. You're very knowledgeable, and you're helping small businesses. And Lord knows we need all the help we can get.
Well, last time you were on the show, we got a lot of comments, so that's why you're back on. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. And again, if anybody, I usually do a blog on my website on different topics, not just tax, but just all kinds of topics regarding finances. So look out for that. And I also have a newsletter. It's not a normal financial newsletter that if people can opt in on too. It's more commentary on businesses and stuff like that. It's not your typical finance article.
You don't pull punches either.
No, I usually will say what comes to my mind, and I'll write commentary on something, and be what it is, you know. But I mean, it gets picked up a lot. I wrote a blog recently about the circle of life, about because I'm at that age where my kids are in college, and I have a father who's got Alzheimer's, and one of my kids paid for dinner for the first time on their own and then offered to buy my dinner, and I was like, wow, you know. So I wrote a whole blog about how it's come full circle, and hopefully she'll take care of me like I'm taking care of my dad, you know.
She's not suing you for her college education?
No. No, that'll be thrown out of court.
Well, let's hope so. But again, thank
you.
All
right.
Bill.
Hey, listen, you have a wonderful evening, okay?
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening tonight. All of our guests are invited because they offer actionable advice to our audience. They do not pay to join us, but rather demonstrate their capacity for helping our audience add profits. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here again next week with other experts to talk about ways to improve your profit picture. Remember, we're here every week at blogtalkradio.com/smallbusinessdigest. If you like what you heard today, tell others about our efforts. If you would like to be a guest or suggest topics for future hours, email me at info@smallbusinessdigest.net. That's info@smallbusinessdigest.net. We would also like to remind listeners that besides our radio efforts, Small Business Digest comes to you via the web, through our video channel, and in our magazine. You can subscribe for any or all of these by going to smallbusinessdigest.net. That's smallbusinessdigest.net. Thank you, and have a good day.